What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 38, and I'm talking to Raleigh. Before we get started here, you may notice a little bit of my voice. It's cold in Chicago, and I am cold and have a cold forever. So you can pray for me for that. I'll take it. But back to Raleigh. Raleigh is a great interview. I really enjoyed talking to him. He's a really cool guy, and he has an amazing story. He kind of went down this road to be a pastor, had the MDiv, and was heading down this road, and life was interrupted by God, by God's call to go out and protect those who are vulnerable, to work at freeing the captive. And so his work is in battling human trafficking in all forms. So he kind of packed up and moved to New York and started this organization called Let My People Go. And they do some incredible work just helping churches figure out how they can practically go about fighting against human trafficking. And it's not like you have to pour your entire budget and everything has to be about that, but there's small steps that Let My People Go helps churches to see where they can really make positive impacts, and it's really practical. He has a book coming out called Vulnerable about this population, about the people who are most vulnerable around us and the people who therefore are most likely to end up in human trafficking. And the book is awesome. It's for pre-order right now. I will put all the links in there. Go check it out. It's awesome. You need to read it. It's just a topic we need to be educating ourselves on, how we use our money, how we buy, how we do all of these things with our lives affects human trafficking. It affects our neighbors. And Raleigh points that out in this interview. It's good stuff. It's really good stuff. So make sure that you're following me on Instagram, that you're subscribed to the podcast through whatever you're listening to it on right now. I would just ask you to go on to whatever you're listening to this on, whether it be iTunes or whatever, and just leave me a rating and review. It just really helps kind of people see that there's something going on and that other people actually listen to it. That's always helpful information for people. So I am putting out a newsletter now. It is going to be monthly, and it's just going to update you sort of on what's coming up, who's in the hopper for the podcast, just to stay a little bit updated. And then I'm going to throw in some random Curry stuff where I nerd out about something random. I have no idea what's going to be happening, but I will guarantee you this, people. It will be entertaining and it will be worth your time. So make sure you have signed up. You can find that on my website, curryblanford.com. And I hope you enjoy this interview with Raleigh. Well, hey, Raleigh, thanks for jumping on the podcast with me. It's really nice to meet you. I'm excited to chat. So,
no, thank you, Curry. I'm really excited to kind of get into this.
Yeah, that's awesome. So why don't we just jump off here and just have you introduce yourself to everybody?
Well, my name is Raleigh Sadler, and I'm the founder and executive director of Let My People Go, which is ultimately an organization really bent on empowering the local church to fight human trafficking, this big mega issue, by loving those who would be most vulnerable to it. I have a book coming out called Vulnerable: Rethinking Human Trafficking, where we kind of take that theme and say, what does it look like for people like you and I, who we may not be survivors of extreme trauma, we may not be law enforcement, we may not be social service workers or nonprofit leaders, how can we fight trafficking in a way that helps and heals and doesn't promote more discord and brokenness?
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you to answer my own, you know, questions and about all this stuff. So why don't we just go down the path of your story, though? How did you sort of get to where you are?
Yeah, so I went to the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. I graduated in 07, and I was thinking, you know, surely I'm going to get a job as a campus minister. I mean, I felt good. You know, I looked at my resume and I'm like, this is solid. Like, people are going to be chomping at the bit. But we were also in the middle of an economic recession. And so no one was hiring, and I didn't get a job for 3 years. And in that process, I was taking any job that I could get. And I took some bad jobs, man. And and during that process, like, I ended up getting a job at an orphanage. And that was where God began to show me his heart for vulnerable people. I remember one of my coworkers looking at me and saying, once these kids age out, all it takes is someone to say, I love you, for these kids to do whatever they ask. I don't know what to do with that. And that stuck with me. Wow. And I found my way. A couple years later, I get hired to serve as a campus minister at a historically Black college and university. And it was there where several bishops and professors took me under their wing and began to show me how to live in balance, to not only proclaim the gospel, but to demonstrate it. And it was in that context that I took some students to a conference called Passion in Atlanta. And they were talking about human trafficking. And it was there where I felt a distinct call to fight human trafficking, even though I had no idea what it meant.
Wow. That is awesome. That is a great story. I have so many questions, though, about that. Okay, so can you talk a little bit about being a campus pastor at a historically Black college? Because you are white. And so I feel like maybe there's some stuff there to delve into.
Yeah. It was an incredible opportunity, because oftentimes when we're coming from a majority context, we do not know how our brothers and sisters of color have been impacted by society. We don't know oftentimes their experience without listening, and really listening for understanding and being willing to hear hard things that you don't want to be true, but may be true. And it was a great opportunity for me to just learn that some of my assumptions in life were wrong, and that injustice is a big thing, and different people have different experiences of the world. And if we don't start listening to one another and valuing each other as the image of God, then we're really missing out on some elements that I would say would be key to flourishing as a society.
Yeah, that's good. I guess I'm putting you on the spot maybe a little bit, but what were some of the assumptions and some of the like key learnings that you had from that period of time?
You know, that is a great question. I think one of the assumptions was, I probably, and I put this in the book, so I'm not outing myself too bad. When I moved to take this position, I remember I had this belief that if you preached justice and mercy, then that meant you were leaning maybe too far in a theologically left direction.
Sure.
And for me, I had heard people over the years say, well, you know, if you focus on that, then you're not focusing on the gospel. And honestly, garbage like that. And truth be told, no, the gospel is holistic. The gospel involves the whole person. The kingdom is the reign of God coming for all of us so that we can experience freedom holistically. And so ultimately, I kind of came to a point where I realized that justice walks hand in hand with the gospel. And ultimately, the greatest act of injustice and justice happened at the cross over 2,000 years ago. And that frees us to be just and to do justice in our communities and to care for our neighbors in a way that they deserve, in a way that they are owed.
Oh, preach. I love it. Such good stuff. We're 7 minutes in hearing some preaching. I love it. I think that's such good stuff. So how did the transition then from campus pastor to building a nonprofit happen?
You know, it's funny because I felt this calling, and this calling was basically born out of a sense of repentance. You know, they were Christine Kane, who runs A21 or A21. She was speaking at Passion, and she was talking about how we all, whether we know it or not, create a demand for human trafficking by the entertainment that we watch, by the food we eat, by the clothes we wear. And this can kind of be a soul crushing bit of information, you know, like,
yeah,
you never want to be the guy at the party who walks in and says, oh, you see that shirt? You're fast fashion. Slaves probably made it. You know, you're probably not going to be the most popular guy. But at the end of the day, that doesn't mean it's not true. And so for me, that kind of hit me. And I realized that if I wanted to be part of the solution, I had to own the fact that I was part of the problem. And I think a lot of us want to engage human trafficking and we want to set the captives free and we want to just dive in, but we're not knowing how we're perpetuating a system that is ultimately exploiting our brothers and sisters around the world. It's exploiting our neighbors that we see as well as the neighbors that we don't see, the neighbors that are making the products that we crave. And so we have to own the fact that we're creating a demand. And so I kind of repented of that. And immediately after, I got this strong sense, and I don't think I'd ever experienced this before. I have this strong sense that I am supposed to do something. So I just did what any normal person would do, and I ran from it. And I kept running until my life basically fell apart. And my job went the way of the buffalo. They cut collegiate ministry in West Virginia. And so all of us were looking for jobs. And I came to a point, and it really came to an end of myself, where I sold everything and moved to New York to fight human trafficking, even though I didn't really know what that meant for me.
Okay. So, so you had a bit of a Jonah moment, I guess, right?
Oh yeah. Totally. Yeah.
Okay. I like those. Those are always, they really cement, you know, your own like sin and brokenness, you know, like running from God. I feel like it's nice and humbling, right?
Well, and it tells you, especially in the latter years, that this really had nothing to do with you. And the things that are happening aren't because you're amazing or phenomenal. It's because God is really, 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 really gracious.
Amen. Yeah, we could all remember that lesson a little better, I think. That's good stuff. So selling everything and moving to New York, though, let's delve into that a little bit.
Yeah, so you do what you normally think to do. You say, okay, I'm going to sell everything. I'm going to raise support. I'm going to, basically, I said two things before I moved to New York. I said I'd never raise support, and I would never move to New York. And, you know, God loves that stuff. And so it came to a point where I couldn't find myself anywhere else but there. And so sold everything, started serving as a college pastor at a church because that's what I knew. And I wanted to kind of do like a human trafficking ministry on the side, you know, something small, maybe start a nonprofit, but keep it real small, you know, like just focus on that church, maybe try to get people in the community to contribute, that kind of deal. And that's just not what happened. And the doors opened in an opposite direction, and I found myself working with multiple churches. And then certain media outlets started doing stories, and we started doing panel discussions. And then there became a demand around the country for kind of what we were doing and how we were trying to engage churches, because we weren't coming into churches saying, hey, let's just give you an awareness training. We're saying, traffickers target vulnerable people. Who are those most vulnerable in your community? We want to help you love them in a way that honors them and honors God as well.
That's good. It's funny when God gets something moving, it's like, oh, hold on, I didn't expect it to do what all of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you just kind of go with it. And I mean, and you ebb and flow. I mean, you have moments where you're like, wow, this is pretty impressive. And you start like believing your own press, and then God sends you some really negative press, and then you're like, oh, yeah, well, if I got to believe my positive, I got to believe my negative too. And there's this humbling journey. And I found that a lot of people who are doing this biblical justice journey and they're loving their neighbor, it's very easy to burn ourselves out, to live for acceptance, to just get involved in the wrong things. And unless the gospel is our motivation, I mean, we're going to do this 2 years tops at most.
Yeah. So I think that's a great point. And how do you personally go about making sure that that happens? I mean, is it just sort of going with the flow or? Yeah.
So when I moved to New York, I was working about four different jobs, all kind of, and I was volunteering too. They were all kind of involved in human trafficking in some form or facet. And it was a way to learn. And I had had a passion to start a nonprofit, but I didn't know what that would look like. And I was willing to give that up to pastor and all that. But I came to a point where there was this moment, I'm sitting there, I'm at the church where I was a lay elder, and I realized I wasn't doing anything well. our own congregation was like, hey, you know, nice to see you. Man, I'd love to see you more than maybe once every month. That'd be nice. If you're a pastor of ours, that'd be nice. And it just got to a point where for me, I was burning the candles at both ends and through the middle. Mm-hmm. And my board lovingly, I stepped down from the church. I stepped down from all the other responsibilities. I stepped into Let My People Go full time. And my board lovingly said, you need to think about self-care. You need to think about a plan that can ultimately promote your resilience and your longevity in this work. And it was a hard talk, but I did that. And I think having a good, solid self-care strategy, as well as thinking through, okay, how do I preach the gospel to myself? And how do I surround myself with people and with relationships of people who will see past my brokenness and see the wholeness of Christ and say, and speak to that? Like, how do I dive into that? And so having good friendships and regular friendships, as well as strong counseling, because if you're in this work, if you're in a work of justice and mercy, you need counseling or coaching or whatever you have to call it to get to sleep at night. Like, if you're like, well, I just have good gospel-centered friendships, whatever, just something to where you're able to speak to someone and have them speak the gospel back to you and to remind you that you're not crazy and that you're loved. I mean, these are things that everyone who's loving broken people needs to know, because as we're doing that, we're going to be reminded of our own brokenness consistently.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good word. I think especially in, like you talked about, organizations where justice is the key, it's really easy to like feel that sense of self guilt. Like, I'm not doing enough, right? Like, there's all these injustices and I see them because that's my job. And, I'm not doing enough, right? That I feel like that lie could get perpetuated really easily.
No, and sometimes like those in whatever movement you're in could say, wow, look at so-and-so, and man, I'm not that. So you find yourself getting jealous. And one of the things that I learned early on in my time in New York that's really, I believe, helped me, not to say that there haven't been moments, but I feel like it's kept me from like a disposition of bitterness or jealousy, is this idea of celebrating other people's successes, because I feel like the gospel frees you to not be about you. And the fact that Jesus lived, he died, he rose, and he's at the right hand of the Father, ultimately speaking on our behalf, that frees me to be able to say, you know what? I'm impressed with what Diana did. That's phenomenal. I'm glad she got that opportunity. She's amazing. And when I live in that place of celebration, you know what happens? When God starts doing things in my life, one, I'm not as arrogant about it. And two, people come alongside of me and they're like, good job. And yeah, I think it's a beautiful thing. But you have to keep an eye on yourself, and you can't think that you're immune to that.
Yeah, totally. That is such a good word. I had never thought about celebrating other people's successes as the a sort of antidote to, you know, so many of those things creeping up in our lives. I love it. There's a quote by, I don't know, John Maxwell, who probably quoted somebody else on down the line in leadership, you know, but it's that the hardest person you'll ever lead is yourself. And I feel like that's a lot of what you're talking about, is that self sort of leadership. And
yeah, because, you know, we have a limited amount of emotional energy, physical energy, psychological energy, all that stuff. And at the end of the day, if we're not taking care of ourselves, we have nothing to give others.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. And when you learn it the hard way, it gets even more ingrained, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit then about Let My People Go. Can you talk about what you do and what it is and all that stuff?
Yeah. So I would define human trafficking simply as the exploitation of vulnerability for commercial gain. And so within human trafficking, you have sex trafficking, you have labor trafficking, you have domestic servitude. In developing nations, you also have organ trafficking. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes those who are trafficked are those who are most vulnerable. They are populations that are not protected or do not have the resources to be safe from exploiters or would-be exploiters. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes we'll think, oh, wow, well, you know, it's just sex trafficking. And that's not true. You know, at the end of the day, even here in the United States, someone could be trafficked for sex, labor, domestic servitude, possibly organ trafficking. But at the end of the day, like, it's the vulnerable, most vulnerable populations that are targeted. It's your homeless neighbor. It's your immigrant neighbor. Whether they have documentation or not, a trafficker really doesn't care. Mm. You know, a trafficker is excited about our division that they see growing because they realize, wow, I've got like the keys to the castle, you know? Mm. And so what we're saying is, what would happen if the church was able to identify and respond to the same people? And what would happen if the church could be a safe place? Like, the congregation in and of itself was equipped to empower, identify, protect, and include vulnerable people in their local congregation. And also, the church was able to collaborate with local stakeholders who are already doing that work, so that the church doesn't have to reinvent the wheel, and they don't have to be perfect. They don't have to have the largest budget, but they just have to be available. And if you could do that with the gospel as your motivation, not doing it because you want to be loved or approved, but because you are loved and approved. In my book, I interview Dr. Michael Horton from Westminster Theological Seminary. And I ask him about this, and he says, if you are well-loved, you will love well. Mm. And I think that's key for us. And so, yeah, that's ultimately what we do with Let My People Go. And we also have, we have a partnership where we go in and do that and help the church develop a justice ministry team to do the work. We also do justice weekends where I'll go in, or someone from the organization will go in and train and teach. We also do the Let My People Go experience, where people can come to New York and do this on the ground in a 3 to 5 day trip.
Wow. That sounds awesome. I love that. I think that's such an amazing vision. Can you talk just a little bit about the practical ways that that tends to play itself out, like in churches and whatnot?
Yeah. So when we work with a church, we're saying, okay, we want to help you create a justice ministry team. That justice ministry team is going to do a community needs assessment. You're going to go out to the stakeholders. You're going to go out to your community. You'll be talking to the school board, social services, local law enforcement, even those who are most vulnerable themselves, asking them, what do you see? Who are those most vulnerable? What are the needs in this community? And how can a church like ours come alongside of that? Mm. In doing that, you're not coming alongside to create a program. You're coming kind of like what I said about being at the HBCU. You're coming alongside to listen for understanding and say, you know, if God has really put us in this community, then how do we best serve this community? Mm. How do we promote this community? How do we listen to this community? And yeah, that's where we start. And so, yeah, practically, like, one of our church partners that we partnered with early on, a church called City Life Church, it's a smaller church plant in Ridgewood, Queens. And they were part of our pilot project. And I'll never forget, Pastor Nathan calls me one day and says, I need help. What do we do? What happened was, he was reaching those who he identified as vulnerable in his community, and they were new immigrants. And he was giving out coats. He was partnered with another NGO, and he's giving out coats in the city. And this was basically something where he's like, he knows that this is not a long-term fix, but this was a way to start a relationship.
Yeah.
And so he met a young woman from Central Asia. She had just arrived here, and they couldn't really speak because there was a language barrier, but she was able to communicate. She got a job next door. He was excited for her, and he was looking forward to seeing her again, but he didn't know how he would see her. A few months later, the people in his community said, there's a brothel advertising on our Facebook page. Could you look at that? And so he looks at it, and he sees the face of the woman to whom he gave a coat. So he calls me, and she's in a provocative pose, and it's horrible, like being trafficked. And he calls me, and I said, we need to connect with local law enforcement. And what happened because of this one collaborative relationship was 24 illicit massage parlors in Ridgewood, Queens were shut down because one church took an interest. And so you don't have to be superstar. You don't have to have this incredible budget. You literally have to make yourself available and say, my neighbors, even if I walk by these neighbors, they are made in the same image as me. They have the same worth as me, the same value. And you know what? If we invite them to their church, God may be working through them to address brokenness in my life. And so it's not like, let's go help them so we can lift them up. No, we're all vulnerable and we all need help and we need each other. And so ultimately, that's what this is about, is saying, yeah, we're going to help you, but we're hoping that you help us.
Yeah, that is so good. I love that so much. You just hit, a major point in all of this stuff. Like, it's really easy to prop ourselves up as the saviors, right? Like, we're going out there, right, and we're going to help and we're going to take care. Like, not realizing the value that vulnerable populations have in our lives, right? I mean, that's so good. I love that.
Yeah, thanks.
So good. So my wife and I do a lot of work with kids from hard places, you know, adoption and foster care and stuff. And that's one of those things that like creeps in so easy. You know, we're saving these kids, right? They need a savior. Like, no, Jesus, man, Jesus is their savior, right? Those kids are probably going to save you, you know, at the end of the day. So, hey, something you mentioned earlier really intrigued me, and that was at the Passion Conference. Christine Kane was just talking about ways that we contribute to trafficking that we don't even realize. Can you talk a little bit about what some of those things are?
Yeah, so I think a great way to start this conversation would be to have someone think about really their purchases, you know, because at the end of the day, the almighty dollar gets the largest vote oftentimes. The things that we see, the things that we experience, the things that we eat, they are there because there's money for them. And, you know, if there's a demand for something, there will be a supply. Now, people want to make profits. And so for us, we often don't think about that. We don't think about who is impacted by what we're receiving. We just kind of want the things that we want. And one way to kind of figure out the trail that you're leaving behind you, the wake that you're leaving behind you with your consumption patterns, it's to honestly go and take the survey at slaveryfootprint.org. Mm. You can log on here, and it's going to show you through a series of questions that how many slaves are working for you to give you the life that you enjoy.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it's sobering, but it's basically the experience I had. And yeah, we can look at that and be like, oh gosh. Or we can look at it and say, wow, maybe I need to take some positive steps in this direction. And the beauty of the gospel motivating you, it's saying, you know, the law says I'm a sinner. The gospel says that Christ took that on himself for me. So now I'm free to stumble towards the kingdom. You know, I'm free to try this and not be overwhelmed with guilt if I don't get it 100% right.
Right.
But to say, hey, for the next 6 months, I'm just going to drink coffee that, you know, is fair and free, or I'm going to eat chocolate that is fair trade, or I'm going to buy sweatshop free clothing, or maybe I'm not going to buy knockoff purses, you know, or knockoff clothing, or, you know, we have a problem with that in New York City. You know, people will be like, well, I don't want to get a Ferragamo whatever, but I want a Ferragami, you know, because it's a lot cheaper, you know, that kind of thing.
Right,
And I found that if you do this and you just start taking positive steps, you're ultimately investing in the world in which you want to live.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. I guess I got to stop getting my knockoff handbags.
I know. I know. I was going to talk to you about that. It's just no good, man.
It's right. Yeah. It's tough. I just got to break it though. I don't think about that sort of stuff. I don't think most of us think about that sort of stuff on a regular enough basis, you know, like where our money even goes, right?
Well, you know, a cool thing to do, and a lot of people think, you know, they might think that this is pretentious. I don't think it is. We all go to the grocery store and we read the nutritional labels because we want to care about ourselves, right?
Yeah.
We're like, ooh, this is all sugar. Maybe I'm going to go with like some Mucilix or something like this. No, I'm not doing this cereal. But then we don't think to look at labels to care for our neighbor. But when we see a fair trade label or a direct trade label or an equal exchange label, that chances are that product's going to be good for us, but it's also better for our neighbor because it ensures that that neighbor is being paid fair wages, that there are procedures in place to safeguard that person being taken care of as they take care of you.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about some of those labels and even sort of what they mean? I don't even know that I know all the time, you know, what even to look for per se.
Yeah. Well, and I definitely go into more detail in the book, but suffice it to say, fair trade is a certification that those who produce your goods, whether it be the, you know, the coffee plantation or the farm where your chocolate is coming from or what have you, they sign on and companies sign on. And so they buy into this certification and ultimately ensures that people are being taken good care of. Mm-hmm. Direct trade is kind of like that, except it skips through the certification and it's basically ensuring that the company has healthy and fair wage practices and labor practices mm-hmm. with their producers and that they're paying them fair wages. Mm-hmm. So ultimately that's kind of the warp and woof of what's behind those two.
Okay. Okay. That's helpful. I feel like that's one of those things you see, but don't necessarily know what it means. You know, and when I worked at Starbucks, it was like fair trade was coming out and I knew it was important, but you don't always know exactly what it means, I guess. You know.
Yeah. And I think Starbucks like had a goal of making like 1% of their coffee fair trade by 2020. And some people were like, oh, well, that's terrible. That's a lot of coffee.
Yeah. Right.
But also, their other coffee, they do have very good relationships with those who are growing it. And so yeah, it's finding those places that are doing a good job and rewarding them with your patronage.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm friends with some people who own a coffee shop and like he actually goes down and sees the plantation and you know, they work, he works with the guy he buys coffee from. And I feel like that's a trend maybe in some of the smaller places too, you know, the craft coffee shops is to have relationships with these farmers as opposed to just buying bulk and not knowing, you know, A, what your beans are like, but you know, also who's, you know, processing them, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's cool stuff. I love that. Well, since we've mentioned the book, we've broached the topic. Let's talk. I'm excited to hear all about the book. So what prompted you to write the book Vulnerable, right?
Yeah. So ultimately, this book is written for people like you and me who want to know how to fight human trafficking, but we have no idea. Because oftentimes when we hear about a subject like human trafficking, we will either feel overwhelmed to the point where we do nothing and it hopes that someone else does something, or we'll channel that feeling and we'll say, you know what, we're going to do the first thing that comes to mind, but chances are that's the worst thing that you could possibly do. Right. So what this book is saying is that human trafficking is the exploitation of vulnerability for commercial gain, but God motivates vulnerable people like you and I to love other vulnerable people by becoming vulnerable to the point of death for us. Yeah. And so we trace this theme throughout the book and say, how can you love vulnerable people in spite of your own vulnerability? More than that, how can you love vulnerable people through your vulnerability? Because that's the one thing that though you think it disqualifies you, it actually qualifies you for the task ahead.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, vulnerability is a tough topic anyway, though, right? I mean, no one wants to acknowledge vulnerability. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. We think it's a bad thing, you know, and no matter how you cut it, you know, it's this feeling of exposure, this being open to attack or harm, I think is how Merriam-Webster defines it. Mm. My friend Brooke Axtell, who has a book coming out soon, which, you know, I'm really excited about. She's an incredible leader in the anti-trafficking movement. But yeah, she describes it as the experience of an unmet need, where others will describe it as being transparent. So you could say, well, I was really vulnerable today. You're saying I was transparent and I shared things and I may have shared too much. But we also experience vulnerability when we are experiencing an unmet need. You know, like I need housing, but I don't have it. I need money, but I don't have it. I need love, but I don't have it. And so all of these things can make us vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, and we, especially as Americans, like if we have needs, our goal is to just meet our own needs, right? I mean, that's like our, that's our mantra, right? Like I can take care of myself. I'm independent. I can handle the situation. Yeah.
Yeah. It's this principle of scarcity, right? This idea that resources are running out. And for fear of that, we act in accordance to that. We want to make sure that we are taken care of. And what that leads to is we focus on protecting ourselves over protecting others. Oftentimes we see this in the workplace. We see this in the church. You know, I'll never forget when I was in seminary, I was going to a movie and a friend of mine was like, and I was getting to know these new people and they were like, hey, the movie's about to start. Would you wait for so-and-so so that they would know how to find us? And I said, nah, forget that. I'm looking out for number one. And I bolted and jumped into the movie theater. But I feel like we do that all the time. Yeah, like we want to protect ourselves at the expense of protecting others. And it doesn't work like that. You know, Jesus says you will be lambs amongst wolves. I mean, there is an aspect of vulnerability that is integral to our mission as Christians.
Yeah. Reminds me sort of like Jesus saying, you know, for those who are first in this world will be last and the one to come, and those who are last are first. But like the people who place themselves first in this world, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
That's good stuff. I love it. I love it. So I'm sure statistics and stuff are part of the book, like the need, the perceived need of human trafficking in the world. Can you talk just a little bit about what are some of the, I don't know, statistics, or what are some of the more surprising facts about human trafficking that sort of the average person would not know?
Well, one, that there are as many as 40.3 million people around the world who are impacted by what has come to be known as modern day slavery.
Whoa.
Yeah.
40.3 million?
Yeah. Yeah. As many as 40.3 million. But you know what? It could be more, because at the end of the day, these are estimates. And if you think about it, human trafficking can happen anywhere because there are vulnerable people everywhere. And so you think about those who are vulnerable here domestically, but also those who are vulnerable internationally. It's a $150 billion industry.
Wow.
You know, it's 99 billion comes from sex trafficking, where 51 billion comes from labor trafficking. But there are far more people who are trafficked for labor than there are for sex. And I draw that distinction because we have to know that when we hear the term human trafficking, it is not synonymous with sex trafficking, but it's happening everywhere. And it's not just happening to people who are being trafficked over U.S. borders from international contexts. It's happening to people here who have an unmet need, whether it's food or housing or love or acceptance, and they're being exploited by those closest to them. It's not always a strange or danger thing. Most times people are trafficked by someone that they know or someone that they have some form of a connection with.
Really? Mm-hmm. I feel like I even have like lots of misconceptions about what this is. Because I mean, I think we've been ingrained to sort of think human trafficking. And I mean, the first thing that comes to your mind is sex trafficking, right? I mean, that's sort of, that's just how I think how it's been presented. What exactly is labor trafficking though? What does that look like?
See, here's the deal. Like until we realize that victims of human trafficking are hidden in plain sight right behind our assumptions, that our core beliefs can often betray us and the people around us. Like until we realize that, we're not going to be able to see past our initial responses. Like we see someone and we're like, oh, that guy's a bum. Well, one, chances are you're probably wrong. And two, you can't write someone's narrative really without listening to their story. We don't know why that guy is living on the streets. Oftentimes, trauma is at the core of this. And so people have experienced exploitation in some form or fashion, and now they are in a rough place and they are I mean, easy pickings for a would-be exploiter. And so, yeah, for us, we really have to say, okay, like with labor trafficking, it may be that person who's selling trinkets on the L or on the New York City subway. It may be that person who is working in the restaurant that you go to. They're cooking. It may be that person who is holding signs for an organization, or that person working on a construction crew, or that person in who's changing your sheets after you leave a hotel. We don't know what's happening. And the only way to figure it out is to actually get to know people. It's to move from this transactional model to a relational model where we say, hey, my name's Raleigh. What's your name? Tell me about yourself. When you go into the nail salon, you ask a question. You know, not that I normally go to nail salons because, you know, I tend to bite
my... Everybody needs a good petty every once in a while. You know,
it's a thing. But like at the end of the day, like wherever we go, we got to ask questions and get to know people and not just see people as people who are giving us a service, but new neighbors to love and care for.
Man, you just... So much good stuff. I'm really enjoying this just because it is, and it's speaking to me in the ways that I just get complacent about these sort of things, right? It's not that like any of us don't know these sorts of things, right? It's you need to be reminded of these things, I think, over and over again, and putting ourselves in positions where we can be reminded, I think, is really important. What are some of the best ways you think to break down that barrier to move from a transactional to a relational model?
You know, this is going to sound really simple, and it may even sound cheesy.
Okay.
But doing one thing you fear a week. Because, I mean, we see it in churches. We surround ourselves with people who are like us, people who are safe, people who aren't going to take much out of us. We want to kind of live in our bubble. Now, we want to risk as long as it's cool and other people are watching, but we don't want to risk to the point where it costs us something. And I mean, this just flies in the face of what the Bible tells us to expect about living as Christians in an evil age. I mean, you are going to experience pushback. And though we all hate it, I hate it. I don't like it. I like everyone to say, you know what, Raleigh, you're great. But that's not real life.
Right.
You know, and at the end of the day, you're going to suffer. And so I think for us, doing one thing that scares you, you'll find that, I mean, that's the closest way to find that what God is calling you to do in that moment. I mean, I told you my story, selling everything and moving to New York. It was like God honors risk because it's a radical expression of faith. It's saying, you know what? I may get to New York and everything may fall through. But you know what? If that happens, God will be the same God of that moment as he is the God of this moment. And so that's where I generally challenge people to start, is find something that you can risk once a week and pull that thread. You know, as you pull that thread, you're going to find where you're led. You know, you're going to find where God is leading you. So,
man, what a great practical tool to some of this stuff. That was awesome. I think, man, I'm like challenged by that. I think that's such an important thing for us to be doing. Cause you're right. Jesus didn't come and say, hey, I'm going to go away, but things are just going to be totally cool, you know, and like easy for you. Right. He's like, no, I'm going to send the Holy Spirit and you're going to, you know, you're going to go out and you're going to, you know, make disciples and you're going to, you know, change the world, right? And it's like, it's never going to be easy.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. The one thing I would add is one of the things I love about this book is I approached it from, like, right before I wrote it, I remember thinking, am I going to approach this book as a learner or a quote unquote expert, you know? And I approached it as a learner. And there's six sections to it. And in each section, I interview and have a conversation that I basically transcribe in a book with an expert. You know, one is the former ambassador to combat and monitor human trafficking for Barack Obama, Ambassador Luis de Baca. interview him. And then I interview the founder of GRACE, Godly Response to Abuse in Christian Environments, Boz Chavijian. Then I, about engaging people who are vulnerable, I talk to Diane Langberg, who is probably one of the strongest Christian voices on trauma that's out there. She's been a trauma therapist for 45 years. And, you know, and then interview Michael Horton and have these conversations. And what's fun is the whole book is about when you engage with other people, your life changes and their life can be set on a different trajectory. And so that's really the whole thrust of the book is, yeah, this is scary, but you can do it.
That's awesome. I love that. I think that's important work. I mean, what you're doing is just such important work. And I love getting to hear just about what y'all do. It makes me excited for churches to be able to be empowered. Cause I feel like a lot of times, my own church and in churches around us, we just don't know what, literally just don't know what to do, right? There's so many needs. It can feel so overwhelming, right? Like getting, cause it's always like getting people behind this thing and getting people behind this thing. And what is the new, you know, coming up? But I think you offer like really practical helps to all that. So yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's, I mean, I found if you keep it practical, people may actually do it. And if you show people that it's not as hard as we think. I mean, that's what keeps us from doing things.
Right.
It's actually pretty easy in certain ways to at least get started.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's interesting, even around me, we're in the western suburbs of Chicago in Wheaton, but there's a huge refugee population not too far from us. And, you know, you just think about that is a vulnerable population. I mean, and it's so close, you know, but what are we doing to, you know, engage that population? And, yeah, it's good stuff. It's really good stuff. So awesome, man. Well, are you, cool if we jump into the final two questions, or do you have some stuff that you feel like we need to hit still?
No, that'd be great.
Okay. All right. So, my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Man, I am glad you asked this question because someone asked me this last night and I am prepared to answer this
awesome.
Question.
I love it.
The strangest job that I ever had. Well, I told you I graduated from seminary and couldn't get a job to save my life. And so I took the first thing that, you know, I could get. You know, I've always seen myself as someone who likes people and can network, you know, upon occasion. And I got a job where I'm like, I'll be able to network with churches and hopefully get a job out of it. You know, if someone meets me, then of course they'll be willing, you know? So I right. went from being really cocky and like sure of myself to being like, I will take whatever I can to like get in front of people so that maybe I'll have a shot. And I worked for an organization. You know what? I will not say their name, but I will describe okay. what they do. Okay. An organization that sells picture packages to faith community, and they go okay. into your church and they will offer you a free 8x10, and they will say, hey, you know, if you get your picture taken, we'll give you this 8x10. And then it's my job to upsell and say, you know, well, you really, that 8x10 is great, but you need wallets and you need an 11x14 on your mantle and you need, you know, the whole nine. And yeah, I found myself traveling all over the Midwest. And I basically discovered that there's just a lot of corn out there. Yeah, I've driven through a lot of cornfields and a lot of incredible, incredibly amazing small towns where I was like I was in love with it, but then I'd be like, oh, now I have to actually leave the downtown area and go to work and sell these picture packages. And it was just, I was on the road, like, 6 days a week. And
that is bizarre.
I didn't love it.
So did you actually take the pictures? I mean, you were the photographer? No. Okay.
No. I was just a okay. sales guy. And then there was another photographer and I wasn't good at selling the product. And I think for me, I would always try to like undersell people and be like, you know what?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I found myself like being really empathetic and I was like, you know what guys, like, you could buy this $1,000 picture package, but man, if you just spend like $300, right. you're going to get everything you really need. Like, And so because of that, I wasn't getting the sales that I needed to. And, you know, at the end of the day, my employer and I both decided it was probably best to part ways. And, you know, there may have been pressure, but from them and them being like, you need to sell more. And I'm thinking to myself, but I don't want to sell more.
Yeah.
So, but that was kind of, honestly, in my life, that was kind of a low point, you know? And
well, did you have an MDiv at the time?
I did.
Wow.
And I was driving around in my 91 Ford Mustang, which was basically a beater. And it was breaking down all the time. And like, yeah, my small group at church basically pulled me aside and said, hey, we know you want to do ministry, but maybe you just need to get a job, like a real job. And it was hard to hear, but I got a job at an orphanage, and that's where God really started opening my eyes. Yeah. So I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing had I not worked that job.
Yeah.
Picture company.
That's amazing how God does that. Every story is just like this random thing. I love it. It occurs to me too that your story is full of people that you've surrounded yourself with that can like speak hard truth to you.
Yeah.
I really like that about your story. So.
Well, and that's the thing, right? Like we all want to be that person who's willing to speak hard truth to our friends, but it's not always easy to hear hard truth. And, right. Sometimes you need friends who can be able to take it when you're acting defensively and being like, no, that's wrong. I am that awesome, you know,
yeah,
but like, totally. I look at it as just, I mean, a trajectory where there have been seasons where I was willing to listen. And those are probably the times where you grow, when you get to a point where you're like, man, this is a hard season and I don't know how to fix what's going on. And when someone comes up to you and says, you need to get a big boy job, and you're already in that place, you're really apt to receive it. And you say, okay, but, pray for me. You know, this is scary.
Yeah.
And I feel like what I love about that is the people that we're trying to help are often the people that help us. Hmm. And often when we try to help people who are hurting, it exposes our own hurt. And so
we
need a community. I mean, a community is the antidote to the loneliness and isolation that we feel on a daily basis. Like, though we want to go off and lick our wounds, we need people who sometimes will just sit there and say, you know what? I love you. And you're harder on yourself than you should be. And we're here for you. And we love you, even if you don't love you right now. Like, we all need people like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Truly. Truly. That's awesome. That's good stuff, man. I love it. Okay. So finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom into their work?
Wow. Someone who wants to bring God's kingdom into their work, I think the first thing is to think through, like, the beauty of the kingdom is it's something that's given. You know, we receive it. And oftentimes we hear about this reign of Christ and we're like, okay, but what does this do? And we get into our head and we start thinking too much and we start.
Yeah.
And like, I think one of the best ways to point people to Christ is, you know, to go and stand for the people that you're with, to tell them, hey, this is why I do what I do. And to not shirk away from proclaiming the gospel, but to not shirk away from demonstrating it as well. And I found, like, in a workplace, being a good friend, being a loyal friend, being a friend who is there for the people in your workplace, being that person who shows up when someone's like, hey, I got to move, or hey, I need to talk about this, or that person who helps with projects, like, that's huge. That is really huge. And I know it may sound simplistic, but it can be very helpful.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I think it's the little things, right, that really make the difference. It's not the grandiose, giant things a lot of times.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Well, thanks. I can't thank you enough for being willing to come on and chat with me. It's so cool to get to see what you're doing. I love it. I'm pumped up. So yeah.
Yeah, this has been great. Sure. Thank you, Corey.
Well, hopefully you will. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I love it. I love it. So hopefully we'll catch each other around
Sounds
at some
good.
Point. So
all right, see you later.
I'll see you later, man.
Bye.
Hey, well, I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. I just really got along with Raleigh. I really think He had some super practical stuff for us all. And I think it's just something that we need to be stepping into. If we are Christians and we're compelled by the gospel, then that gospel has to compel us to free slaves. I mean, that is what it is. And so I would encourage you to take some of those steps, pick up the book Vulnerable that Raleigh has coming out February 1st and take that challenge. I took it on the internet, your slavery footprint challenge, and it was sobering. It's just sobering. We need to be thinking about where our money goes. There's a reason we can buy stuff insanely cheap, and that's because somebody paid for it somewhere down the line. And so I think we could all use to think more about that, how we use our money, and use it for the kingdom in a greater way. So I hope you enjoyed. Make sure you're subscribed to get future episodes. I got some great stuff coming at you. So many good people. You don't even know the half of it. So it's fun stuff. It's enjoyable. And until next time, get out there and hustle.